It is a pleasure to welcome you to the first of our Tuesday seminar series in the Middle East Center. And tonight it is a double pleasure because the event that we are organizing, we are proud to be organizing with our colleagues from the European Studies Center's Southeast Europe at Oxford program as joint hosts with the Middle East Center for tonight's book launch, where we can celebrate the publication of the Oxford Handbook of Religion in Turkey. I am Eugene Rogan, and I am the wrong man for this job. We had been counting on our colleague Laurent Mignon taking the chair because the subject is one so close to his own heart and to his research, but he is unwell, and he's asked me to stand in on his behalf, and I do so with a heavy heart because I would so prefer to be in the audience hearing Laurent Hoxha share with us his views on this important new book, which contributes to a series of works that Oxford has been bringing out that really stands as bringing the leading scholars on issues of key interest to researchers to address in an enduring fashion a subject that we know will have long-standing interest. And the question of religion in Turkey is, of course, one such topic. We are lucky to have with us tonight two of the editors and two contributors, and I will introduce them in that order. Firstly, we have Caroline T, who is professor of anthropology of Islam at the University of Chester. Her work engages ethnographic approaches to the ways in which Islam has lived in the contemporary world, focusing on the intersection between religion and institutions of modernity, such as modern science and political secularism. She's the author of The Gülen Movement in Turkey, The Politics of Islam and Modernity, published by IB Taurus in London in 2016, and is currently principal investigator on a three-year research project entitled Muslims, the Secular, and Existential Risk. Caroline, welcome. I'm also pleased to welcome Fabio Vicini, co-editor with Caroline, who is associate professor of anthropology at the University of Verona in Italy, and founder and convener of the Muslim World's Network of the European Association of Social Anthropologists. Located at the cutting edge of interdisciplinary inquiry in anthropology, Islamic studies, and social theory, his research has investigated how, in the last 100 years, Muslims have been rethinking the Islamic tradition through the conceptual apparatus of modernity, while continuing to rely on long-standing Islamic debates self, discipline, connectivity, and transcendence. His most recent solo-authored book is Reading Islam, Life and Politics of Brotherhood in Modern Turkey, which Brill was proud to publish in 2020. He's recently co-edited a special edition of Halep, Journal of Ethnographic Theory, dedicated to divine presence in Islam with Lili Dikupo. Fabio, pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
And then among the contributors, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Sertaç Sehnikoğlu. She's associate professor at the University College London's Institute for Global Prosperity. Just for the name of the institute, you have to want to work there. Formerly, she was the Abdullah Mubarak Sabah Fellow of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at Pembroke College, University of Cambridge, and Gibbs Traveling Fellow at Newnham College, Cambridge. Currently, she's the principal investigator of a European Research Council starting grant for a project Imaginative Landscapes of Islamist Politics across the Balkans to Bengal Complex. Dr. Sehnikoğlu has two books and has edited several special issues in leading journals and is currently serving as the reviews editor for the Journal of Middle East Women's Studies and the co-editor-in-chief of contemporary Islam. Our fourth and final speaker, it's wonderful to have you with us. Welcome to the Middle East Center. Is Stefan Williamson Fa, a research associate at the Center of Islamic Studies, University of Cambridge. His research examines the intersection of Islam and the senses, particularly sound and taste, across Turkey, the Caucasus, Iran, and Europe. He completed his PhD in social anthropology at University College London in 2019, and has held research positions at the University of Birmingham, at Lund, and in the University of Oxford. Stefan's first major ethnographic project explored the role of sound in 12 Shia Muslims' devotional practice and everyday life in Turkey and the Caucasus. His findings have been featured in leading academic journals, including Cultural Anthropology and the International Journal of Middle Eastern Studies. His forthcoming monograph, Sonic Relations, will be published in 2026 with Indiana University Press. Currently at the Center of Islamic Studies, Stefan leads Food Encounters, a project examining changing Muslim food ways in the UK and Spain. This research explores responses to food insecurity and environmental challenges while investigating food as a medium for fostering interfaith and intercultural relations. Now, I don't know about you, dear audience, but as I read through the expertise of our four speakers tonight, the one thing that strikes me is I am desperately curious to know how four such diverse scholars have approached religion in Turkey. Let's find out. May I invite to the podium Caroline T. And with a warm welcome, please.
Thank you very much, Professor Rona, for that very warm introduction to the four of us. Thank you all for coming. It's lovely to see such a full audience this evening. And thank you for being willing, Professor Rona, for standing in for Professor Mignon tonight, who was the instigator of this event. Lauren contributed a characteristically excellent chapter to the handbook entitled Religion and Literature in Ottoman and Republican Turkey, which I highly recommend. He also generously then invited us to launch the handbook at St. Anthony's College. We miss him here this evening, and I know we all wish him a very speedy recovery and return to work. So the idea for a handbook of religion in Turkey was born just over 4 years ago, in the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was perhaps a reflection of the isolation we all felt in lockdown that the idea of a large collaborative project bringing together colleagues and friends from across the international spectrum of Turkish studies appealed. It was also perhaps a reflection of the slight madness that affected many of us at that time that we thought proposing a 34-volume chapter volume was a sensible idea. But there was clearly a gap in the literature on religion in Turkey that could be usefully filled by a large scope handbook. Not only would this make the richness and complexities of Turkish religion more visible and accessible to a wide audience and be immensely useful for undergraduate and postgraduate teaching, but it would also bring together both junior and senior colleagues working on religion in Turkey and facilitate cross-pollination of knowledge amongst us and a useful awareness of the current parameters of the field. When we were planning this launch event, Laurent suggested it would be of interest to the audience to hear something about the highs and lows of putting the handbook together over the course of the past 4 years, and to share in some of the things that went wrong as some of the things that obviously went right, because we've seen it through to completion. I'm afraid to disappoint you all. This has been a strangely straightforward project, and there are no hair-raising anecdotes, mishap or misadventure to amuse you with this evening. Much of this I attribute to the co-editorial team, Fabio Cini, who's here this evening from Italy, we're delighted to have him here, and Philip Dorrell. So Fabio, like me, an anthropologist of Islam in Turkey, came on board very early on, thankfully, and was followed by Phil once we realised that we needed somebody outside of anthropology with expertise on Turkish theology and also with expertise on the non-Muslim religions in Anatolia. Phil was the ideal fit for both of these areas. But being based in South Carolina in the States, he couldn't travel to be with us this evening, unfortunately. But it is really important that we stress he's played a very key part in bringing the project to its completion. And the integration of a 5-chapter section on religious minorities, as well as the 2 sections on Turkish theology, is thanks to him and his expertise in those areas. So the overarching goal of the handbook is to address 2 core intellectual problems that we identified in the study of religion in Turkey. The first of these concerns the dominance of secularism as a field of study, often at the expense of Turkish religion. And the second concerns the relative absence of Turkish theology in the academic study of Turkish Islam. Now, I'm going to hand over to Fabio to say something about these 2 themes before I return to take us through the table of contents a little bit.
also Jenny Williams for inviting us and making this event possible. As Caroline was saying, for sure one of the main motives behind the idea of collecting the chapters composing this handbook is that the study of religion in Turkey has long been a neglected topic in academia. Today this might seem ironic given the association between Erdogan's policies and Islam in Turkey that's been spotlighted in the news in the last two decades. But this is how things were until the late 1990s. The situation was very much related to Turkey's history of secularization since the foundation of the Republic in 1923. The strict constitutional laicite implemented by the founders of modern Turkey is unique in a Muslim context. This policy caused the temporary disappearance of religion from the public sphere and made Islam possible to survive only underground, at least for the first three decades of the Republic. It also had a long-lasting effect on Turkish elites and hence on Turkish academia. Accordingly, in the scholarship on Turkey up until the 1980s, there was almost no mention of Islam whatsoever. If Islam was ever named, it was seen as a relic of the past, which was deemed to disappear soon from the fabric of Turkish society. These views were in line with what at the time was a particularly vocal perspective in social and political studies, modernization theories. In the 1960s, authors like Daniel Lerner and Bernard Lewis sanctioned that, different from other Muslim countries, Turkey was deemed to follow in the footsteps of the West, and that hence Islam would disappear from society. Not accidentally, these theories reflected the views of Turkish secular elites, who saw Islam as backward, as a dross of the Ottoman epoch. In these views were the reflection of the same intellectual milieu, that of westernized secularist elites, influenced by positivist views on human cultures and societies. Things changed only in the 1990s, following the political opening toward religion that took place after the 1980 military coup and with the government led by Turgut Özal, a turning point for religion in Turkey, mentioned in most of the chapters of the handbook. In those years, scholars like Sharif Mardin start to open a door for the study of Islam in Turkey, something unthinkable and also highly undesirable only a few years before. It is in the footsteps of these early works that our handbook aimed to follow, bringing together the best scholars who have been working on religion in Turkey in the last 20 years. But this secular effect is also related to the other main point Caroline has raised before, that is the relative absence of Turkish theology in the academic study of Turkish Islam. As Republican Turkey made a turn away from its Ottoman past, it also did from its Muslim Middle Eastern neighbors, seeking to emulate the industrial, political, and societal modernity of Western Europe. Although this impulse has faded off late under the AKP, the legacy of Turkish republicanism and the cultural disconnection from neighboring Arab Muslim societies still linger. For various reasons, then, the study of modern Islamic theology in Turkey remains relatively marginalized in the wider field of Middle Eastern and Islamic studies. One significant part of the problem is language. Rarely do scholars working in or on Turkey have proficiency in Arabic. And the same is true in reverse, meaning that the exchange of expertise on Islam in the Middle East region rarely crosses borders between the Arab nations and Turkey. Second, the Ottoman theological and intellectual traditions have rarely been considered at the level of classical Islamic literature in Arabic. The same is even truer for more recent theology works in Turkish, which are also particularly affected by the Turkish modernization project, a topic that is addressed within the handbook. Accordingly, one of the core aspirations of the handbook was to make the study of Turkish Islamic theology accessible to a broader, non-country specialist audience. We aim to do this with two sections of this volume entirely dedicated to the topic. But I will now give the floor back to Caroline to illustrate this and the other sections that make up the volume.
Okay, so I'm going to take you through, essentially, the table of contents. I'm hopeful you're all aware that the handbook is largely published now online. It's available the website. As you can see, it's not arranged yet into sections, which it will be once it's finished and the hard copy is produced sometime later this year. So for the purposes of what I'm going to do now, I'm going to switch to a PDF. But do please visit the website. It's available, the link on the flyers there out in the hallway. So the table of contents, first thing to say is that the chapters highlighted here in red are currently free to download for a period of about 2 months. And that's an introductory taster that MEP have kindly offered to get the volume off the ground. So those ones are currently available. If you don't have an OUP subscription, although probably most of you do. I'm pleased to say that the contributors to the volume, who number, I think, approximately 40 to 45 people, are comprised of, well, I can tell you actually, it's 22 men and 20 women have contributed to the volume, so it's quite an equal balance of gender contribution. The handbook's divided into 8 sections, each comprising between 4 and 5 chapters. We begin in part 1 with a treatment of religion in the transition from Ottoman to Republican eras, exploring normative state-level discourses of the early 20th century, as well as historical studies of Alevis and Kurds. One of the groundbreaking chapters in this section I'd like to draw your attention to is by Martin van Brunessen, in which he explores the presence of Kurdish madrasas alongside official Ottoman madrasas and traces their fortunes over the course of the 20th century. This focus on Kurdish religious institutions is significant in a subfield of Kurdish studies, which is primarily concerned with questions of ethnic identity and resistance to the Turkish state, and in which Islam is rarely mentioned. This is in spite of the richness of the Kurdish religious landscape and its contribution to Islamic intellectual trajectories in Turkey. We then have the first of 2 sections in focusing on Turkish theology. And this first one addresses theological trends in Turkey over the course of the 20th century, including Sufism, Islamism, and neo-spiritualism. The section begins with Philip Dorrell's very accessible survey of the work of the 2 most influential Republican era theologians, Hüseyin Atay and Bekir Topaloğlu, and the influence on them of the Ottoman theologian İsmail Hakkı İzmirli. The third section looks at different expressions of Islam, both Sunni and Shi'i, in the Republic, using the rural-urban distinction as a comparative paradigm of analysis. And we'll hear more from Fabio and Stefan, 2 of the contributors to this section, in due course as this panel goes on. Section 4 turns to minority religious groups in Turkey. And this section is a key contribution of the handbook. Christine Robbins' chapter on the Yazidis is the first to analyse this understudied community and contextualise it uniquely in its Turkish context. The chapters on 3 different Christian Orthodox groups, as well as Judaism in Turkey, augment our understanding of their 20th century histories, but also importantly give voice to the experiences of those communities in the present day. These communities have been seriously understudied throughout the 20th century, and I'm pleased to say that each chapter has been written by a young female scholar and benefits from really exciting original research. Section 5, Religion, Art and Culture, is dedicated to analysing the intersections between religion and literature, architecture, music and TV and film. The chapter on the Hagia Sophia by Bisera Pencheva, a field-leading expert on Byzantine architecture, is particularly noteworthy and makes accessible to the general reader the building's complex interplay between Byzantine aesthetics and religious ritual experience. Pencheva introduces the so-called aesthetics of the sea, which are invoked by the Hagia Sophia's marble interior and floor, much of which has been hidden from view with its conversion to a mosque, first in 1453 and again in 2020. Section 6 addresses Islam, religion and politics, and tackles controversies and contestations around religion in the AKP era, picking up again on Alevi and Kurdish experiences. The historical and ritual dimensions of Alevism are introduced by Yanina Karolowski and Benjamin Wienick in the first section, the historical section. But here, in this part, Jeremy Walton and Çiçek İlengiz explore the attempts of different Alevi groups to achieve official recognition by the modern Turkish nation-state, showing how this quest has been complicated by internal diversity amongst Alevi civil society organisations and their differing views of the legitimacy of the Dianet, the Directorate of Religious Affairs. Section 7 looks at some recent developments in Turkish religion and society, including the experiences of Muslim women. Serntaç Sehligoğlu is with us, and her co-author Merve Kütükkuliş explore the emergence of a new type of Muslim womanhood, which is desirous of agentive, consumerist, and entrepreneurial lifestyles. Cenk Özbay's chapter in the same section on LGBTQ communities shows how a history of what he terms mutual exclusion between LGBT groups and the state has given way under the AAP to more aggressively homophobic state policies that are consciously inscribed for the first time with a religious rationale. And the concluding section returns to theological themes. Feyza Burak Adlı's chapter is dedicated to Islamic feminism, focusing on the exceptional case of a Sufi Sheikha. And Pierre Hecker presents an emergent topic in Turkish studies, the rising numbers of atheists, or what are known as religious nuns, in Turkey in the last decade and a half. His chapter examines theological discourse on non-religion, which is offered by popular theologians, addressing matters of individualized religiosity and the crisis of organized religion that has been engendered by the dominance of the AKP over the last 20 or so years. So that's a quick skim through the content. I'll leave you to have a look again online for more detail and direct you to those free to download chapters if they're of interest to you. But that's all we wanted to say by way of introduction. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Caroline. And thank you very much, very good to get from the editor's perspective the challenges of trying to bring together what is such an impressive monument to scholarship in this area, and really opens up avenues that I don't think any of us might have gone to on our own. It's where in having a collaboration between a group of editors and the brainstorming that enables will allow you to come up with, again, the broad matrix it would take to do justice to religion in Turkey. But of course, it still asks the question, why would people get involved in a multi-article project like this? Since we have two contributors here who were drawn into the matrix, I wonder if we might just ask Serntaç first.
Sure.
Serntaç Hanım,
sure.
How is it that you came to write for this project?
I actually, when I saw the question you guys emailed, I was like, okay, am I the right person to start the conversation with? Because, so by the time Fabio reached out to me to join this I didn't know how fabulous it will end up becoming, of course.
Thank you for your trust.
My initial, so that was a couple of months into my 5-year project, and I was terrified to start something so massive, right? It's a project in 11 countries. And then my initial response was like, I won't have time to do anything. And Fabio responded, Serntaç, did you see the deadline? We have quite a bit of time, actually. And then that calmed me down. And I'll just, I have to say, when you're being invited to a project like this, one of the things you pay attention to are the people who are putting it together. So both Caroline and Fabio are very well-respected scholars who did amazing job in reaching out to a very kind of exclusive groups. They're very liberal, right? Gulenists are very liberal, but they're also, when people like Gulenists have been studied for decades, over a decade actually, so many books, so many publications written on them, but every time you read one of these articles, you realize they couldn't go, like the scholars couldn't really integrate into the group. So you would kind of question their ethnographic skills, their kind of ability to communicate, the way they might be building barriers with the secularist tone, except with the two works published by these amazing scholars. I was honestly, genuinely impressed by their work and their ability to advance the overall anthropology of Islam by using these communities. So I trusted that. And I'm so happy because in the end, so for those who are working on Islam in Turkey, you could realize everyone is there. That's what I was saying to Caroline. Like when I saw some of them, some of the names you couldn't see, right? Some of them weren't published, so we couldn't see them on the board here.
No, everyone's names are on.
Yeah, everyone is here. Yeah. Okay, then you have seen the full picture. Yeah. Everyone who are very important figures who worked on Islam in Turkey, they are here. So we are, which means the following, which means for an author, like contributor like me, which mean it means that this book will be read for several years to come.
Yeah.
And the other thing, so she was highlighting how the diversity was addressed, but one of the things you didn't mention actually, which was visible to me, You guys were including all these like native scholars, like scholars who grew up in Turkey, who became experts of Turkey, who obtained their expertise. So it's kind of when you put together a collection like that, it's inherently decolonial. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the strengths I was seeing in the end, which I didn't see at the beginning. I just trusted the two scholars. And I'm solely 4 minutes, I guess, so I should shut up. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tatyana. And Stefan, really the same question to you, which is, how was it that you came to be drawn into the project?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's similar in the sense that when Fabio approached me, I trusted him. And I think maybe it's a bit of a biased panel here in the sense that we're all anthropologists, but as Caroline just showed, you know, there's a whole range of different disciplines there. But I think maybe my anthropological biases meant that when I heard Fabio and Caroline were doing this, I thought, well, this isn't just going to be like an encyclopedia of religion in Turkey. There's going to be more to it. And I think that's kind of what attracted me. Although I think in the end, my chapter, maybe because of the lack of other scholars working with the community I work with, pushed me to do something which was maybe a bit more encyclopedic in the sense that I tried to lay out, you know, the history of one specific community and the details of that. But I think, you know, what we see here and from the chapters that I have read, you see that it's, you know, you get these deep insights into Turkey, into religion in Turkey, but there's also elements there which are kind of pushing kind of debates within disciplines and really making us think about stuff which is relevant to people beyond Turkey, I think. You know, important debates about religion, about Islam, about all sorts of other themes that come up there. So I think, I mean, I knew they would do something that I would like to read myself, so when they invited me, I thought, great.
That was company you wanted to be in.
Yeah.
I get it. Well, looking at the table of contents, it really does seem to capture the kind of state of the practice as it is at this stage of the 21st century, and with an ongoing relevance that means that deep into the 21st century, it will be a book of reference. But what's fun is that you guys have worked very closely together. You do have a good sense of each other's contributions. And yet, as I understand, you still come away with questions for each other. So in this next stage of our presentation tonight, I'd like to give you each that chance to put to one another the questions that you bring to the table as you come to the publication date. I should note, publication date was yesterday?
No.
We don't have a hard publication date. So everything is pretty much online already.
Yeah.
We're just waiting for the editors' chapters, because they were the last to come in, would you believe?
Naturally.
Yeah.
I think Oxford University Press is more forceful than you are in having declared yesterday as publication day.
Has it? Really?
I think so. Oh. So
they didn't tell us.
The editors are always the last to learn.
Okay.
But
well,
as you launch the book, with congratulations, maybe now is the moment where you can put the embarrassing questions to each other that you didn't dare ask before. Yeah. Where would you like to start?
So we have some questions. We thought what would be good use of time, which might give you a kind of a flavour of the depth of the volume without taking hours and hours, and also without risking superficiality, was for the four of us to read each other's chapters again and to frame each other with a critical question that could just tease a little bit of commentary out of each of us on our own chapters, some of it for co-written. So we've done that, and we haven't planned an order to go in, but...
Shall I start? Or?
Why don't you start?
Oh, I will start, okay. I will start with my question for Stefan.
And if you would ask in a loud voice so everyone in the back room can hear.
Thank you. No, I have a problem with my voice. Okay, Stefan. In your chapter, you masterly introduce the reader to a relatively unknown and understudied religious group in Turkey, which is the Shia community. And you do so through a particular lens, what you call the significance of sound. In the chapter, you describe how a sound allows for the redefinition of the space of Shia Islam in the public sphere and the emergence of a transnational Turkish Azeri Shia community. Actually, this point reminded me of another chapter of the handbook, in which Timur Hammond, a geographer, illustrates how the reopening of some Sufi lodges in Turkey in the last decades has been accompanied by the emergence of new narratives that allow Muslims to reconnect with their Islamic past. In your chapter, you point out that sound makes something similar for Shia communities. However, you also claim that sound is a specific kind of materiality, different from others, like, for example, the lodges Hammond talks about. So here's my question. Can you say something more about the specific materiality of sound that you discuss in your chapter?
Okay, so maybe just to start by saying what my chapter is about. So as I mentioned, my the chapter, because the chapter is about Twelver Shi'i Muslims in Turkey, and usually when I tell people that I'm working on Twelver Shi'ism in Turkey, they assume that I'm working with Alevis. And there's many Alevis who are not happy with that conflation, and there's many Shi'i in Turkey who are not happy with that either. So the community I worked with on my PhD research and in the years following that are Twelver Shi'i Muslims. They live primarily in close to the border with Armenia, in the provinces of Kars and Erdal, where they make up a sizable percentage of the community, of the population there. So even though they are relatively unknown within Turkey, in Turkish they're known as Jaferis, if they're known at all, within those provinces they are very present. And I guess one thing that I do in this chapter is really try and kind of just lay out, like explain a bit, you know, who this community are, what kind of issues that have been important to them over the last 100 years, and how they relate to other groups and how they organize amongst themselves. So that takes up the bulk of the chapter, and then I kind of go into my real passion and interest, which is sound and thinking about the senses. And I think for Twelver Shi'i Muslims, I mean, if those of you who are familiar with Twelver Shi'ism will know that devotion to the family of the Prophet, the Ahli Bayt, 12 Imams, is incredibly important. And there's a lot of ritual practice and devotional practices which kind of center around these figures, these early Islamic figures. And what I found in my research was that, you know, at the center of all these rituals and practices was sound, practices of reciting poetry, of lament, but also of praise. And that's something that I've been particularly interested in, and I talk about in the chapter. And I think what's also interesting is how sound is a way of, or has become a way of, kind of marking the presence of this community, both within the eastern provinces in Kars and Erdal, marking the presence in the public space. So since the 90s, early 90s, there's been a kind of a movement or a move of community rituals from kind of hidden, kind of public, private spaces. You know, people would meet in the early Republican period, people would meet in their homes and hide and have their rituals in private, to the 90s when people started coming out into the streets and performing their rituals in public. And there you see sound really playing an important role. And in these rituals, in these kind of public processions that you see now in the eastern provinces, but also in Istanbul, Ankara, places where people have, Shia have migrated to, sound and the amplification of sound is a way of kind of saying, you know, we are here, and making themselves heard. And I think the difference there is that maybe to these, I haven't read the chapter you're mentioning, but in the difference between the kind of sound and places or objects or shrines is that, you know, sound takes up space in a different way, or can kind of resonate and move in ways which things, other things can't. And I think what you see is that there's a real desire to kind of make noise and be heard. And that's something that I kind of look at here. So I guess that kind of movement, the way that sound moves is quite particular. And again, I talk about the role of the importance of the circulation of devotional media, so recordings, and how recordings travel, audio recordings between these communities in Turkey and also other communities, Shi'i, Azeri Turkish speaking communities in the Caucasus and Iran. So sound travels in kind of different directions, and through that movement, kind of community can kind of make itself be heard and mark its presence, but also kind of expand its boundaries beyond its kind of local context. So as these recordings travel, you have the kind of creation or formation of transnational Shi'i communities. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you want to ask your question?
Oh, yeah. I just have to put it out. My memory's not so good. So,
I have your question here with me. We exchange a question. Yeah. No secret then.
So, I mean, I think what Sertac's chapter really does so well is really challenging the assumptions about the lives of Muslim women, both kind of these popular ideas of what Muslim woman should be doing, and also these kind of academic discussions around kind of gender and Islam, which have been kind of focused on particular forms and practices, especially kind of ideas of piety. And I think what I found really interesting was the way that you kind of emphasized the kind of multiplicity and complexity of Muslim women's self-making practices. The chapter really provides a nuanced perspective of the desires and aspirations of women, of Muslim women in Turkey, through an ethnographic focus on kind of two realms of leisure, physical activity and fashion. And I think you push the reader to kind of move away from kind of obsessing about piety and Islam, and to think about how kind of these multiple things can exist at the same time, you know, how these different desires exist. And I think that leads me to think that, you know, even though you really kind of push us to think about the multiplicity in people's lives, I'm also kind of left wondering about when or how these different kind of aspects come together at times. So, you know, this kind of the life of, or the role of, or the desire for kind of to participate in kind of these leisurely activities and to be kind of a pious Muslim are shown to be quite separate. But are there no instances when these come together?
Thank you. Yeah. So I'll again, like, I think I'll follow your lead and start with, you know, saying what the chapter was about. So this is the co-authored chapter. I co-authored it with Mary Kutu Kurish, who is based at Boğaziçi University Sociology Department. And she recently had a baby, so congratulations to her. And there was no way she could fly, obviously, and travel here. So her book is going to be out soon. She specialized on Muslim fashionistas, right? The kind of these figures who are kind of being followed by other Muslim women for their fashion, sense of fashion and trends. And I kind of contributed the part on, so we both worked on leisure. We put this together, focusing on Muslimhood and gender and leisure, right? The kind of, and how can we kind of bring this together? And my angle is based on my ethnographic fieldwork conducted really long time ago, over 10 years ago, in women-only gyms in Turkey, in Istanbul specifically, right? So women-only gyms are where, you know, women go to work out, and like you might have expected for me to do, I was expecting to see mostly hijabi women, headscarf-wearing women, when I go to women-only gyms, which wasn't the case, which has given me a very interesting perspective to think about these kind of issues related to public sexuality and piety, etc., etc. And then, I ended up writing quite extensively on specifically these distinctions, right? On, you know, where does piety begin? Where does it end? And all these complexities. So one more thing before, you know, I start fully answering your question, I think I'm kind of creating, doing the framework here, is one of the things that was happening when I was writing up my book was this entire debate on everyday Islam, right? The kind of those, you know, in this room might be very familiar with this debate, so I'm not going to kind of get into any of the details, but all these things about, oh, is there too much Islam in anthropology of Islam? That kind of Samuel Shelke's very famous question. It was followed by so many publications, some of you guys are part of already. You know, like kind of when do Muslims stop being Muslim and how complex this is. Now, so I want to start with, I think, saying that there's a challenge, an epistemological and theoretical challenge in studying Muslim selves. We have a preoccupation as kind of scholars who were trained in the Western part of the world, in the kind of Europe and North America. And when we hear someone who happened to be Muslim, we expect Islam first, right? Kind of, there's this kind of preoccupation that's shaping our expectations. And I know this because I've been presenting on these topics for almost 15 years now, and these are the first questions I get, you know, how many hijabis were there, like how do I define veil? I think that was after a presentation I did on women's gaze across each other's bodies in changing rooms. So how women are, you know, checking all these norms, beauty standards, by staring at each other's bodies in changing room where they change bras, in other words. And then the first question I get was, how do you define the veil? Like, why do I define, like, So we have this preoccupation. So I think that is even more like that difficult, that epistemological challenge becomes even makes our job as scholars working on Islam and Turkey even more challenging, because we have two main problems. I'm very simplifying here. I have only 10 minutes left. Two main problems. One is this kind of very ongoing like political debates on, you know, looking at Turkey and seeing Islam versus religious versus secular, like Islam versus Kemalist. Four?
Yeah.
Okay, 4 minutes is up.
Finish your main.
Okay, all right. And the second is the kind of like we are not very familiar with Turkish Islam, this kind of multiplicities existing in Turkey about, you know, when people drink every other day, go only to Friday prayers and stop drinking during Ramadan to be a good Muslim. So where do we put this in terms of piety discussions? So I think going to these leisure areas is giving us the ability to look at self-making that is not pious self-making. Okay. So I think I want to preserve this, and just because I seem to have eaten up all my time, I want to say one more important point, that when you are studying, it makes sense if you are studying piety, you go to where? You go to a mosque in Cairo. Like, have you ever been in Cairo? Piety is palpable there. It's there. And then in mosques, then you can so you can really focus on piety. Then I think what we need to do as ethnographers, as scholars, is to go to different spaces just so that we could capture these kind of multiplicity. So of course, people are still thinking about the next prayer time when they're exercising, but their full selves, just as we are more academically inclined or intellectual selves when we are here, they're more leisurely, they're more having fun, they are having more swear words in the gym. So that's, I think, a good wrap up. Thank you.
We were conscious of the time.
6 minutes.
Don't worry about it, actually. We'll have time for questions from the audience. I really want, I think your questions to each other have a lot to contribute to our understanding of the book. So why don't we finish with this part?
Okay. All right. Cool.
Okay. So now it's my turn to ask the question.
Good.
I read a paper co-authored with Caroline and Kimberly.
Kim Shalley,
sorry, I first read Kimberly's chapter, that's one. Kim Shalley's, and it's a very interesting, so I'm guessing you are going to summarize it at the beginning of your answer, but it's basically focusing on the notion of how and why ambiguity characterizes the Gulenist group, his Met movement. He used very consciously this term, and its leader Fethullah Gulen, particularly in their engagement with the good Muslim paradigm under various political contexts, including neoliberalism, including this and that. So given that Islamic tradition, so I'm very kind of inspired by the ambiguity angle. Given that Islamic traditions have historically embraced theological and interpretive ambiguity, so I don't know how many scholars of Islam and in terms of theology are present here, but ambiguity is something that's embraced as almost like a virtue for hundreds of years, right? And we see this still in Sufi thought and some notions of legal pluralisms. And it's been a driving force, the kind of ambiguity was always kind of something people want, like scholars need to keep themselves in, right? Rather than find a certainty. So I wonder whether and how the particulars of your research and your research topic and the movement's ambiguous position is like, and particular by particularities, I mean these kind of, is ambiguity a liability for them? Is it something they're a bit indifferent about? Do they not care about their ambiguous status and how they look ambiguous by the outside world? Is like, how conscious is this? How invested is this? Or is it somewhat an authentic expression of Islam's inherent capacity to encompass multiple meanings and interpretations? So what's the kind of, I think I'm interested in the theological and functional operations of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Zaytash. Great question. So the chapter that Kim Shively and I wrote, like Zaytash touched on, addresses the problem of ambiguity in terms of the way the Hizmet movement, which is inspired by Fethullah Gulen, the way that it's received ambiguously outside of itself. So lots of people know about the Hizmet movement, particularly since 2016, when the failed coup was attributed to the leadership of Fethullah Gulen, still technically unproven, but very much assumed. Even before 2016, people internationally had an awareness of who Fethullah Gulen was and what the movement was that he inspired. But you would find different versions of the movement circulating. So there's a particular kind of self-image that some people who followed Gulen, presented to a Western audience that was very keen to consume a narrative of a modern, progressive, inclusive, tolerant, peaceable Islam. All of these things, we argue, fit into the good Muslim paradigm that Mahmoud Mamdani introduced to us a few years ago. And we argue that the Gulen movement is a really good example of how good Islam, good Muslims, appeal to certain elements of Western audiences and can be consumed in that way. What's interesting about Hizmet is that they know that that works. So a lot of their promotional activities, I'm talking really more about pre-2016, things have changed quite a lot since then, were addressed at filling that hunger for a version of Islam that fitted with a sort of Western liberal democracy, if you like. We also talk a bit about the way that good Muslim image was constructed within Turkey too, according to the Kemalist paradigms of what Islam could be and what it couldn't be. So again, even in Turkey, there's an understanding of how far Islam can go before it becomes dangerous and then it becomes bad Islam. Sarah Thatcher's question is interesting because it's asking about the question of ambiguity from the inside of the movement. Which actually isn't something we get a chance to address in the chapter. I think it's beyond the scope of the chapter. But believe me, this is true. Coincidentally, it is a question I've been working on in a different article. This wasn't a setup. Because I think it is a really important question to grapple with. And the thing I think is curious is the perspectives and experiences of people who were the very, very committed core followers of Gulen, who I did field work with up until the coup attempt in 2016, and their understanding of how controversial the movement was. You know, their understanding of how it meant different things to different people. It was always in the press in Turkey in 2013, 14, 15, accused of all sorts of different things, rightly and wrongly. And the people I encountered in my ethnography had no interest or no connection to these events at all. They had nothing to say about them, no comment to make. And for some interpreters and commentators, that comes off as suspicious, and that's a sort of evidence that there's, you know, a conspiracy. They're saying they don't know anything about it. They're saying they don't care about it. They must do. Surely they do. The whole country knows about it. My judgment, for what it's worth, is that they did know. They weren't being blindfolded. They weren't being brainwashed. They knew of these contradictions and these difficulties in the outside life of the movement, but that they were absorbed in a particular project of personal piety, that there was no space in their lived experience to engage with the discourses coming from the outside. And I think the way that we can understand this is by comparing the lives, the daily lives, the daily habits, the daily interactions of a core group of Hizmet affiliates in Turkey with that of a more typical monastery. And I think there's a degree of monasticism that characterized their ways of living, which explains how they were able to retreat from the world outside, but also embrace entirely a communal ethic. Their commitment to the cause, the central cause, was absolute. And their commitment to one another as individuals was relatively low. And that's something you also see reflected in traditional monastic practice, in Christian traditions I'm talking about here. So I think that's one explanation. I also think Sertac's observation in another article of hers outside the handbook about the inability of the Gulen affiliates to entertain the idea that the Turkish state might be malevolent towards them on account of their experience of white privilege in the Turkish context is really, really compelling as well. I think that comes into it too.
Well, thank you for mentioning. You're so kind.
Was that that wasn't?
You have 10 more minutes, Caroline.
Oh, no, I don't. Fabio, you have four. So I'm going to ask Fabio a question.
He meant based on my math.
Dodgy maths. So Fabio has a wonderful chapter in the section looking at the Sunni Shi'i experiences of Islam in Turkey. I think it's section 3. And your chapter discusses the transformations of Sufi orders in the Republican era, and it shows how traditional Sufi esoteric beliefs and practices have given way to a communal focus on morality. And you describe this as, quote, the moralization of Islam under the aegis of the newborn modern nation state, unquote. And you argue that the Jemats have facilitated the engagement of Muslims with modern society, primarily by supporting an Islamic ethical ideal that's embodied by the community itself and its disciplines of practice. So can you say something more, please, about the marginalization of the esoteric Sufi quest for union with God and annihilation of the self that this transformation entails? And particularly, I'm talking about whether you consider it to amount to a secularization of the Sufi tradition in Turkey and or a full departure from mysticism.
Yeah, thank you, Caroline, a lot for your very good question. It's a very good question. It's also a very theoretical one, so I don't want to bore all the people here that stayed until now too much, but I will try to address it in the best of my capacity in these 4 minutes, not 14. And anyway, I'm kidding. So in sum, in the chapter, I try to explain how basically Islamic communities, Muslim communities in Turkey, in the last 50 years or so, turned into jamaats, which is a particular kind of social organization, let's say. And so I pick up examples from my own ethnography and also from other works on Naqshin Manis and so on and so forth. So in some, what I argue, the point I'm trying to make when I talk about, you know, this moralization of Islam, is something also I discuss in my book, is that basically, to simplify a bit things, I argue that with the introduction of mass education in the country after 1923, new generations of modern educated Muslims appeared, who aspired to get middle class occupations in a modernizing Turkey. And under these circumstances, the old methods of the Sufi lodges, based on the esoteric Sufi quest for the unity with God, were no longer particularly attractive for these Muslims, or at least for the majority of them. This, of course, doesn't mean that such a quest completely disappeared. It didn't for neither the Naqshbandis nor even for the most reformist-oriented streams of Islam, like the Gulen community or the Nur movement. Yet I think we can fairly say that within all these communities, the search for union with God remained more as a sort of an ideal, that is only ancillary to the other more vital, urgent goal of finding ways to cultivate a Muslim pious life while at the same time engaging in secularized, modernizing society. It is at this juncture that the moralization of Islam comes onto the stage, I think, because in Republican Turkey, Muslims had to progressively move their piousness inwards, making Islam the internal core of their ethics of engagement as Muslims in a modern society. The Jamaats facilitated this process by investing in the field of education, reassuring Muslims that they could pursue a modern life, get educated, find a job, and so on, while also keeping up with a pious life, as far as they internalized such an Islamic ethics. So coming to the second part of your question, can this be read as a form of secularization? This is a tricky point, because like with modernization, we have to understand what we mean by secularization, first of all. However, if you follow, for example, Tal al-Assad in saying secularization as the reclusion of religion to the private sphere of the individual, there certainly are some parallels with the process of internalization of an Islamic ethic of engagement that has been favored by the Jamaats in Turkey. Yet, at the same time, and maybe paradoxically, we might speculate on the fact that this internalization process is what has allowed Islam to reemerge with vehemence in the public life in Turkey in the last 20 years, thought under new forms. But I think I will leave it to this, hoping I've somehow responded to your question.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we're done then.
Well, Fabio, Caroline, Stefan, so much. This book, it was Friday, actually, that OUP declared it as published. So I will just say that you're sending that little fellow out into the world, which is an exciting new phase in the life of this project, which you probably questioned would ever come to fruition. But now that it has so, we have to record our debt to you and all your contributors for putting down the marker that you have for all of us who will want to come to a reliable reference to address the whole host of issues associated with religion in Turkey. So for that and for tonight's amazing performance, could I please ask you all to join me in a very warm thank you.